You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to Hamtramck Now and Then, the podcast of the Hamtramck Historical Museum. I'm Greg Kowalski, the executive director of the museum. And with us today is Joe Koschut, who is the chairman of the board of the Friends of Historical Hamtramck, which owns and operates the museum. And today we have a special guest with us. It's Brianne Turchinski, who is the author of the new book, Detroit's Lost Pole Town. And the subtitle, The Little Neighborhood That Touched the Nation. It's a fascinating story. And Brianne, tell us a little what attracted you to this topic in the first place.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on your very first podcast. This is awesome. I went down with my husband to a estate sale in Indian Village. And the story is kind of in the prologue, but I was really drawn to this stained glass window, and I felt like I couldn't leave the estate sale without buying this window. I don't know what it was. It was like an otherworldly pull to this window. And what really drew me was the middle part of it said, God buildeth his holy temple. And it was just beautiful stained glass, very old. And so I went ahead and bought it. And when I took it to a stained glass curator guy that would help me restore it, they told me when I bought it that it was from the Pole Town Church. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what Pole Town was.
Right.
And so when I took it to the stained glass guy, he's like, you got to figure out what church this came from. Because that would just be interesting. You know, he takes stained glass out of churches all the time in Detroit. So for him, that would be a really cool thing. And so I went home and I just became kind of obsessed with this, this story. I was up till midnight looking at pictures and going through the internet and kept seeing all of the photographs of the protests, and swept me up, and it started to transform me. Mm-hmm. And I just was caught up in it, and so I was determined the next day to go and get a book called Pole Town Community Betrayed. And so the library had it, my library in Rochester. And that same day when I woke up, The Record came, which is our Episcopal newsletter for the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan. And I go to the Episcopal Church, so I get this record, it's like a quarterly thing. And I usually don't really read it. I pick it up and maybe glance at a couple things. And this time I opened it up and there was a story about a woman who had passed away. And when I went to go pick up the book about Pole Town, it was the same woman who had died. There were a lot of different coincidences, and I just was pulled to it for the passion out of my heart, actually. I don't know. It's a bad introduction, but I'm a little nervous again.
Well, it's a very emotional story, for one thing. And, yeah. You know, this is a very powerful story. Pole Town, of course, was in the neighborhood that was demolished to make way for the General Motors plant in Detroit and Hamtramck back in 1980-81. And it displaced something like 1,400 homes and several churches and some businesses. St. Joseph Hospital. My mom actually worked there at that time, and it was displaced out of there. So it had a big impact on a lot of people's lives, and it was very controversial at that time. So one of the things that struck me about your book, because there are other books about Pole Town, and there's been a lot of material written about it, but yours is a little bit different. Yours is more of that human angle, that really showed the impact on the person who lived there, not just the overall view of it and, you know, the statistics. The statistics are in the book, but there's much more to it than that, too. You've got a lot of people quoted in there who are residents there who lived through the experience at that time. How did you make contact with these people? And second, you know, what was your reaction to their response after all this time?
Well, I wanted, that's the thing, is I wanted this book to be an oral history of that neighborhood. That
Don't you say it's like a love letter to the neighborhood at some point?
Yes. Yeah, it was a love letter and it was like a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't write it for myself. How could I have?
Right.
I wrote it for the people that went through that. And for even if they're passed away, I still wrote it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted it to be an oral history. I went through I used Facebook a lot to track people down. Gene Stilp, who was one of the Ralph Nader lawyers, he was the one who encouraged me in the beginning to do something because I kept calling him and asking him questions about the neighborhood and about the protests, and because he was right there, you know.
Right.
He ran into the church when they were tearing it down, and he hid in a closet and was taken out in handcuffs.
Yeah,
you know?
Amazing stories. Yeah.
So just all these stories. And but I wanted not only to capture its last moments, I wanted to capture its birth and its adolescence and everything. I wanted to, as you would a human story, you know, I would go to sleep at night and I would feel Poletown because I was listening to so many stories of these people, and I felt like how wonderful that neighborhood was at one point, you know, when it was in its prime and, you know, the children would be playing and the candy shops and the sausage shops.
It kind of draws you into it, doesn't it? The story itself.
Yes, it does because there's so much pain that went through. They kept protesting, and even when they knew that they were going to lose, even when they knew they were losing and they knew that the church was going to come down, they went and beat up an Oldsmobile in front of the GM headquarters, you know?
Right.
And they made sure they did it right at the prime news time and just as like a retaliation or a counter protest is what the news is calling it. And they only did that to show people watching at home, look, when there's an injustice, keep fighting, you know, even when you're going to lose and you know it, because sometimes the powers are just too powerful for the little guy, you know, and, you know, they did it to inspire people. And that is the kind of inspiration that we need today. You know, it's really we need it all time in all time, but I think today, this year, that all kind of came for me. It kind of came full circle in that way. So,
Immaculate Conception Church was really the core of this for a long time as this process went on, and you have a lot to mention about the pastor there at that time. It sounds like he was a very interesting person and really involved in this and deeply emotionally attached to this as well, too. Can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Yeah, Father Karasevich. I would go to sleep at night and I would see his face.
Mm-hmm.
And if Gene Stilp helped me get motivation to do this, also Father Karasevich did, you know, in some sort of weird way, because I was...
he actually died shortly after this occurred, right?
Yes, like 5 months to the day.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go to sleep, I would see his face, and and that's the other thing. I would have dreams where he would show me Immaculate Conception.
Uh-huh.
He would be walking me through the church.
Wow.
And I have never even been there before. Yeah. And I had this dream where he was walking me through it on a top level.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that the choir was up there. You know, it's just weird.
That's
stuff
strange.
Like that. Yes. So that's why I say at the beginning, you know, this was an otherworldly pull. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I really felt like this was something I had to do. It was a calling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being who I am, you know, who thinks about these things in a broader sense, mm-hmm. then I really had to do it, you know, because I couldn't put it down. It was something I would leave the subject and I would go do something else. And then something, I'd be like, well, what happened to this? And I would go back to it, mm-hmm. look up all this stuff, you know, and then I'd get sucked in again.
Yes.
I just thought, you know, I think I need to just sit with this for about a year.
Yeah.
study this thing. So that's what I did.
Well, you could feel that in the book. It's like it had a strong emotional attachment to you, or, you know, a strong emotional commitment on your part, too. And that's kind of what separates it for me from the typical kind of historical recount of an issue or neighborhood or something like that. You can tell when the person is emotionally committed to what they're doing, and that really comes through here. Were you disappointed at anything that you came across, other than the outcome of what happened there?
Oh, disappointed. I don't know. Is there something you have in mind?
No. I mean, did you expect something that did not occur, or your reaction from somebody that you didn't?
Yeah. I mean, I think that. My observation is mm-hmm. that, and I know what happened, and I know how the world works, and I know, you know, everybody was trying to cover their own butts, including mm-hmm. GM and Coleman Young. And but I think for GM, who's kind of, they have that plant there, which they're now calling Factory Zero, which to me is their way of getting further away from
right.
the Pulltown story
yeah.
and the Pulltown name. Instead of doing that, if they accepted the fact that this happened
mm-hmm.
and made amends, publicly apologized perhaps, mm-hmm. you know, that would make them look so good. But mm-hmm. see, corporations, they don't see that. It's like a paradox. They can't see that if they just accepted this thing that they had done,
mm-hmm.
then that all would be good if they could just make a memorial or do something. And I don't know.
Yeah, and like you said, they really don't want to be associated with that.
Right.
If they brought it
nearer to them and said, you know what, we did this and we're not the same company that we used to be.
Right.
Because they're not. You
right,
know,
yeah.
they've grown. We've all grown. And they could put a memorial up or publicly apologize or write a letter to the mm-hmm. Polish community. You know, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
People would forgive them. You know, they wouldn't stop buying cars. They would probably buy more, you know.
And it's hard to believe, but it's really been 40 years since this whole issue took place. But it still strikes a lot of nerves with people.
It does.
Still a lot of connections to that community there. And another thing that people tend to forget, too, is that actually only a portion of Pulltown was taken for that plant. A lot of it, a great deal of it, was left. Mm-hmm. But that kind of withered and died, basically, too.
Yeah.
The area there now is pretty much pretty empty, pretty wide open. And It's you would think it would be ripe for redevelopment, being that it's so well located in central Detroit. So would you like to see anything like that, you know, or have you seen any interest in a kind of redevelopment over there?
I don't know. I mean, I drive through this area, and I would like to live here. Because it just feels good. I've told you this before, that the energy down here, like in Hamtramck, and that could spread. You know,
right.
The energy here is really good. You can feel it when you come in. It draws you. And I think it's because there's so many people, different people living here, and they're all peacefully living here.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel that. It's in the atmosphere. And, yeah, I mean, I don't know, like Tom Olakowski wanted to build like a Pulltown strip,
mm-hmm.
like sort of like a Greek town. And I don't know about that. I mean, I wouldn't want to tackle that kind of project.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody else could. I don't know. So. But I do, you know, you guys have, Polonia exists here still, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, you know, I think on top of that, though, mentioning the sort of diversity here, I think that's why a lot of people flock here, you know, from around the world.
Absolutely.
Like we just had a news team from France come here and do a documentary about living here and just the different people here. So I think it like I said, it draws people from all over the world, and they're wondering how so many different people coexist together peacefully, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and you can feel it. It's in the energy. I'm telling you, this whole place just feels so good. This whole area.
Absolutely. So when you talk where you live, your neighbors, are they still familiar with the Pole Town experience? You know, does that register with people?
Some people have heard about it. Some mm-hmm. people worked for GM at the time. You know, my in-laws are Polish, and they grew up around Hamtramck. Mm-hmm. And my father-in-law, at one point, his mother, I think, lived in Pole Town but moved. So no, I mean, I don't have any personal connection to mm-hmm. it at all. This is completely an adoption. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
like
right.
I don't have any genealogy or any ancestors that came from Pole Town, but mm-hmm. I adopted it as my own, very, my own child.
But you made a real connection with it.
I did. You know? Yeah.
And I think people do that with this area in itself, you know, with,
yes.
with Hamtramck and the whole Pole Town thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you come here, and even if you don't live here, you know, you kind of make it your second home. Or, you know, if you do come here and move in here, you know, you kind of adopt it as your hometown, you know.
Yeah.
That's common, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's rather interesting. You know, it's a different experience from living in other places. And like I've always said, you know, like there's really not too many places like Hamtramck,
yeah.
you know, with the sort of melting pot, the, you know, and I feel like that's how Pole Town was, like, you know,
yes.
going through the book, you see just a bunch of different people. It wasn't just one group of people. You had everybody, you know, all different
yeah.
kinds of people living in that area and coexisting,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it makes it really interesting.
And you seem to catch that sense of neighborhood too, that
yes.
you would see, and that's reflected in some of the photos that you have in the book as well, which are similar to Hamtramck, and the tight-knit neighborhood, the very close houses, the neighbors who know each other very, very well, the local businesses that are known to the people so well.
Yeah.
And it's kind of moving to see that, and to see, you know, to see that old neighborhood like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I wanted to capture everything, especially some of the buildings, the architecture,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you won't see those again. I think where the women lived that worked in the cigar shop
mm-hmm.
Or factory,
yeah.
Their building had these little fleur-de-lis on it,
mm-hmm.
you know, little details like that
yeah.
you just don't see on buildings that are built nowadays. And so I wanted to capture all that and collect it all, and collect as much as I could. And really, honestly, another whole book could be my journey with this.
Really, truly, yeah.
I mean, it just met so many awesome people. And
were you surprised by anything?
Was I surprised? Well, I was surprised at first coming into it, because I sort of have that audacity where I think that
mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the story. So I thought that people would want to share
mm-hmm.
their stories and want to be, you know, interviewed. I think I took it because I was so new at interviewing people. Some people, like, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning photographers and
mm-hmm.
things like that,
right.
did not want much to do with me, because I'm just this little
mm-hmm.
newbie. So, you know, but they were all very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And And, you know, that was, to me, it was kind of like, wait a second, Brianne, you're just like, back up a little bit. You know, you can't expect people to want to share with you all the time, mm-hmm. you know? But, you know, like Taro Yamasaki, I went to his house. He invited me into his house up north, and he gave me coffee, and we talked, and he told me beautiful stories about his father, and, but he didn't want me to interview him,
mm-hmm.
but we could have talked all day.
Yeah.
It was a flowing conversation. And, but that was the stuff I was surprised at, that they could talk to me all day, but they wouldn't want me to interview them for the book, you know? So, that I needed to build up more trust
mm-hmm.
because they were out there so much already. And I totally get that, you know, when you're so exposed, you sort of want control over some things that get put out there. You know what I mean? So I got it. It's okay. But that was still cool.
Is this your first book? Or
I self-published one of my novels, but I've been publishing mm-hmm. articles, poetry, short stories, things like that for about 6-7 years now.
So this is your first venture into history, living the history?
Yeah, my first book of nonfiction, and I have come full circle because I was a history major.
Uh-huh.
So to be in the archives again, and now I'm writing articles for Metro Mode for historic preservation, and that I'm in the archives again. It's awesome to be actually using my degree, you know.
So. Well, you struck a very good balance, though. That's what really kind of struck me with the book, too, because there's a lot of facts and figures in there, but you're not overwhelmed by them.
Mm-hmm.
This is that human side of the story is what really, really shines through and makes this book stand out.
Thank you.
It's a very, very well done.
Thank you.
So does that encourage you? Going to try some more in this this kind of topic?
For sure. Yes, I would love. I have a couple ideas already.
Good.
So they're very weird, so I have to figure out how I want to, the avenue I want to go to, hopefully a publisher will, you know, jump on board. So, but yeah, it's, I can only do what my heart tells me to do. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? If my heart's not into it, I can't do it well.
Was it difficult to write?
No.
Good.
I started researching it. In August, I think they gave me the book deal. So I started, I thought, okay, I'll research beginning of the year before the snow starts to fall. Mm. And it was due in February. That's when they wanted it.
That was pretty tight schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, you might need to extend that a bit. I'll shoot for that, but you might need to extend it. Because I just didn't know with stories like this where a lot of people have died. And because I wanted it to be an oral history,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know how hard it would be to find people.
Right.
And so I spent September, October, going through the archives.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the snow started to fall, I sat in my house and I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And then COVID hit, mm-hmm. you know? So I couldn't... you know, I wanted to visit Father Karasevich's grave some more. I told him I'd come back and bring him flowers in the spring, and I never could do that, you know. And but you know what's weird, if you don't mind me telling you this little story really quick. Another weird one about Father Karasevich. I went to his grave when I was tying up the story, and it's in the prologue how I had a hard time finding his grave because it was all grown over.
Mm-hmm.
It took me an hour, and it was freezing. It was the day I came to interview you.
Yeah.
It was so cold that day, and so I was ready to give up, and finally I found his grave, mm-hmm. okay? And it was totally covered in grass. I spent some time with my boots, like just trying to move the grass away. And so in August... in August when I was handing in there the final draft after they gave me edits and everything, I called the cemetery and I'm like, is there something you can do? Can you lift the grave or clean it up or something? And they're like, oh yeah, no problem. We'll do that. So like a month went by, I never heard anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking a walk at night. And all of a sudden, I just feel Father Karasevich's presence. Like, and I'm not into that stuff, but I could feel, like, I could just feel him. It was weird. So the next day I got up, and the cemetery emailed me and said they had lifted his grave.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, wow, you know, like, I just felt such a strong presence the night before. And so I don't know. Maybe he was saying thank you.
I don't know. Could be. That's great. Great. Good.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything you'd like to add? Any points you'd like to stress? Other than we'll be talking about where the book is available for sale, too. So.
Yeah. No, it just, it was a beautiful story. I felt very humbled and honored to be able to tell this story because, mm-hmm. you know, not being Polish, I feel very honored that everybody shared their story with me that did. I was so touched by that, you know, the people that welcomed me into their homes and into their time and let me interview them. And that was really sweet. And gave me their pictures.
And that was a lot of work, too, wasn't it?
Yeah. Gathering all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it was.
So you mentioned that you could write another book. Are you planning to do another book on Poletown, or are your other ideas just on something completely different?
They're on something completely different. I could try to write something about the journey of Poletown, like how it transformed me as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of all the people I met and just the crazy coincidences. It was really like a spiritual journey for me. And, you know, like I said, it was a calling. And I don't know, it was strange. So that could be a book, but I have other books about historical things, Michigan history and things like that, that I would love to write.
Wonderful. Well, we hope to see more of them, too.
Thank you.
The book is Detroit's Lost Poletown, The Little Neighborhood That Touched the Nation by Brianne Trochinski. And it's available here at the Hamtramck Historical Museum. I have to put that first.